philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Let us cavort like the Greeks of old.
You know the ones I mean.
It's not an easy thing to meet your maker.
No, no, no. They work for each other in exchange for money, which they then...
Well, that just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Eek, barbadurkles.
You sure that's the point, Doctor? Of course. What else could it be? That you should never tell the same lie twice.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 78. How's it going, Aaron?
Going all right. Ready to distribute equally some philosophical pearls of wisdom. How you doing?
Is there somebody that's going to have to sit there and suffer with no pearls of wisdom? Like,
maybe.
In order for the pearls of wisdom to be distributed. How about I'll sit over here and have no pearls of wisdom. And you can use my pearl units to give to everybody else. How about that?
Okay. Well, as long as you're willing to volunteer as our escape, as our philosophical scapegoat, I'm okay with it.
All right. We are talking today about a short story called The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelas, I guess it would be called, by Ursula Le Guin. And I'll admit, I had trouble with the beginning of this one. This is going to be one of those ones where you're going to have to tell me what was happening, and then I'll catch up. But it seems to be a... It's just written really oddly, so I'm not sure I have a handle on it. I think intentionally, obviously. I'm sure the fault is mine, obviously, but it seems to be like it's a hypothetical place and society and stuff, and it seems to be, you know, like challenging this utilitarian idea of distribution of suffering and happiness and all this stuff. But it's like a series of weird hypotheticals that, like, I don't know what I don't get it. So anyway. That's what we're going to talk about, and Aaron's going to take us through it, right?
Yep, that's the idea. And to start us off, technically I think it's pronounced Omelas, according to Le Guin, but I mean, we don't really care about pronunciation Omelas, guides on this show, so I'm going to go ahead and continue to call it Omelas, because
I know, I'd say you'd be the last person who should correct anyone on their pronunciation of a word, but wow, bold over there, okay.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, I like to flip the script Omelas. A little bit. Yeah,
yeah, all right.
So the ones who walk from Omelas.
Yeah. If it had been a story, I hope we'll send you lots of emails on everything you mispronounced. Okay, no, that's fine. Omelas, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I guess we'd better tell Brian to punch it.
Climb aboard, get ready to explore. There's so much to find.
And also, Brian, you want to do the exposition for this one? No.
No takers.
All right. Yeah, I need your help on this one. I normally try to expose myself and do the exposition, but
those seem like unrelated claims, but okay.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. The second half, it seems to be going through hypotheticals of like, okay, what if there's this society that has all this happiness, you know, but it's there's like one child suffering in a room somewhere. And I get that, but the beginning is just confusing to me. I'm not totally understanding what is the first like page and a half? Can you tell me? Riddle me that.
Yeah, so the first page is describing this kind of festival that takes place in Omelas, where, you know, they're all
parading. You
sound
like the comic book guy in The Simpsons, by the way.
Omelas. Oh, comic book guy is the best. So they're describing this festival that they appear to have, I'm assuming every summer, because it's the festival of summer, where they all put on fancy clothes and parade around and have giant parties and things. And yeah, so the story is written in this hypothetical voice where it's like,
yeah,
you know, I'm not going to tell you all the details of Omolas, because if I do, then like one of them might turn you off and that'll like make the whole point go away. So it's just like fill it in with whatever utopia is the most utopia for you.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess I can see that. Yeah, that's what was confusing me. It was like, mm-hmm. is this like an Etch-a-Sketch of like, well, okay, you don't like that. The narrative really is that. It's like, well, what do you think? Is that good? Okay, no, not that. How about another thing? And I obviously got that, you know, that's an intentional thing that Ursula Le Guin is doing. I was not quite understanding why. But when you put it that way, I think that makes sense.
And it's a little weird. I'm not 100% sold on the use of it, because I feel like in exchange for like allowing me to fill in the blanks, it also sort of makes it a little less vivid. And it's just it's a weird mechanism. I'm curious what our audience thinks about this in the way that it's written as well. So it is a little bit distracting, but I think you have the main idea, right? We have this wonderful, perfect utopia, if not for sudden twist, flaw, problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's, I'm so glad you explained that. So it sounds like the problem that, you know, is a problem that I've always had, that I know a lot of our listeners who are atheists probably have, with this idea of like heaven, you know, and whenever mm-hmm. you hear a description of heaven, you're like, well, that's stupid. I don't even mm-hmm. think that would be mm-hmm. that fun. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that, where she's like, consider it heaven, but I'm not going to tell you how it works, because then you'll find the flaw in it, so pretend heaven. Is that kind of...
Yeah,
that makes sense. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's kind of... It's interesting. I like it.
Like a bit of a callback to our experience, like our very first episode with the Experience Machine, where it's like, just describe whatever you want the Experience Machine to do. That's what it does, okay?
Okay, so I'm on the right page now. I get it. I see in the language where that was happening. Thank
mm-hmm,
you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yeah, so we get this set up, and it's like, you know, if you need it to be orgies, there's orgies. And if you need it to be not orgies, there's not orgies. Like, whatever.
Can I whatever just arrangement. Check the box that is, I always need it to be orgies? Is that
it's pretty standard.
I've done a long-standing bit on Comedy Shoeshine that I want some sort of checkbox mm-hmm. that just says I never want a receipt for anything in my entire life ever.
Uh-huh.
When I go buy a hamburger, I do not need a paper trail about it. Like, just stop mm-hmm. even trying. Same with that. Also, when we're talking about hypothetical heaven scenarios, I always need orgies. I just, that should be another checkbox.
I think you could argue that theoretically all utopias will converge towards orgies on a long enough timeline that, like, that's just inevitable. So, yeah. So then we get our freaky twist, right? What do you think about this twist? I mean, it's sort of, I feel like it's been done a million times now in a bunch of different formats, but this to me is sort of one of the myths of this scapegoaty scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this harkens back to our kid trapped in a train compartment mm-hmm. from a minute ago that we just did.
It's kinda, yeah, and a lot of folks asked if we were going to do Omolas when we did Snowpiercer.
Well, we are.
Yep, and
good
here
news
we are.
For them.
But we're going to do different philosophy. That's the important thing. Just because sci-fi is five different tropes repeated over and over again doesn't mean we can't mix up the philosophy a little bit. So Omolas, right? The sort of mythic, it almost feels like a curse kind of situation, like a witch came along at some point and was like, "Bwahaha, I'm going to mess with all of you by making this wonderful, delicious city that only runs on the suffering of one innocent child." So
the whole point is to set up this utopia, and then, you know, like you say, twist. It's not really a twist. I don't think there can be a twist in a story that's four pages. Like,
fair enough.
How do you set up the? It's just four pages. Just you're telling me the thing. There's not mm-hmm. enough time to like, oh, here's my expectations. It will be this, and then you're like, no, it's not that. Oh my god, this is just like too short for that. But anyway, it's a pretty visceral ish description of a suffering child that's somehow like, what do you think it's like? That's like you're saying, like a witch made him a deal or something. They sold their soul. I don't know how the physics of it work, but
right, this goes back to the hypothetical
guarantees their happiness or something.
Yeah, that she keeps it deliberately obscure what the causal relationship is. All she tells us is that if this child is in any way treated nicely or anything good happens to this child, the whole system comes crashing down somehow. So yeah, you know, witch, demon, something like that. But yeah, it's I like it in that it you know, I mean, it is just a trolley problem scenario where every single trolley is redirected onto one person. But like the description of the child, for example, is pretty haunting. The way it's described as being feeble-minded is like being forced to live in its own filth, and like it's afraid of everything and it understands nothing, and like nothing can be done for it. If you like, it's so beyond help at this point that you couldn't even bring it out or rehabilitate it or anything.
Well, and I think that so the second half of the story, I felt like I understood. Fine. Mm-hmm. It was just that first, the way it was couched was interesting. So the second half, I feel like it, I feel like she included that part in there to kind of go into maybe some of the rationalizations that people, citizens mm-hmm. of Omelas would use, you know, because mm-hmm. it's like, oh, well, even at this point, even if we tried to treat the child better, it wouldn't really understand. It's been too long. And the, you know, like I felt like that was going into maybe some of the ways that it could be, I don't know, like people mm-hmm. would justify their own happiness by trying to make excuses for why it wouldn't matter if they helped this child anyway. It's too right. late or something like that.
I mean, some sort of rationalizations have to be occurring if these people are, yeah. if the majority of them are sticking around this city and not being miserable, then there must be some way that they're justifying that to themselves in maybe, like you said, perhaps utilitarian kinds of ways. But then we get, of course, our folks for whom the story is named after, right? Those who just can't quite accept that particular trade-off. Yeah.
And it's interesting. Well, it's interesting because I like the kind of the poetic nature of that, where it's just like there are some people who are just like, we're just leaving. Like mm-hmm. we can't do it. And, you know, it's very, I don't know, this seems to be not very much literal. Like, most of this is, mm-hmm. you know, just is like, okay, they just walk out and they don't even know where they can go. They just leave because they're pretty sure that there's some better way, mm-hmm. but not this. But, like, I can't help but think, like, okay, but you walking away isn't doing anything for the kid.
Yeah.
If you can't fix the kid, then just stay there. What's the point? Like, if you go, why does it matter if you go further away from where the kid is? Does that somehow make it better? Like, all right, there's the one suffering child, but if we put it out past Jupiter, mm-hmm. then it's fine. It's just the proximity that does it.
Yeah, and that's a common response to this story is, why is it they walk away, not they try to change the system or something? The right. story gives you this impression that, like, the status quo is genuinely unchangeable, and so their only option is just to leave or something. But yeah, I agree with you.
I kind of just took it as philosophically. People mm-hmm. don't like this conclusion. They don't like this possibility, so they philosophically, that's why it's so vague about they just leave, they don't know where they're going, but mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. less it says, quote, the place they go toward is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the city of happiness. Mm-hmm. I cannot describe it at all. So I almost wonder then if she's trying to say that this is like inevitable, like you can't really get mm-hmm. out of this scenario.
Yeah, and some might argue that like there is no system that can provide for great heights that does not rely on, to some degree, on the suffering mm-hmm. of some individuals. So I think that is one way to read the story, and it's one way that I think is very interesting. And it again goes back to our discussions in Snowpiercer. And I agree with you that it feels very allegorical, like walking away is rejecting a principle rather than, I mean, I think otherwise, it feels a little bit like it's a kind of dirty hands situation where you just don't want to have your hands be the ones that get dirty by continuing to remain in system.
I see that, but I also think it's like the great, maybe it's the Simpsons. I don't know. It's an old mm-hmm. classic joke about, you know, Christianity, where it's like, well, if Jesus died to wipe away all your sins, you better sin as much as possible. Otherwise, like, what's the point?
You got to make
that sacrifice worthwhile. If this kid is stuck, no matter what, mm-hmm. well, assuming you can't do something about it, Well, then why not make use of the happiness that you're being granted as much as you can? Uh-huh. And then that borders on, like, am I just rationalizing? Just not worrying about the kid?
Go full Omelas. Go all the way. Yeah, you got to go one louder or else it's not worth it. So, yeah, that's our ones who walk away from Omelas. It's very short. It has basically no characters and basically no plot. Yeah. It's like the vignettiest of vignettes. So should we talk philosophy then?
Yeah. So you said it was going to be something different. Are we? Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's hard to not talk about utilitarianism somewhat, right?
Right. We're going to talk about utilitarian. I mean, so the reality is we're going to keep coming back in these conversations to talking about things about, like, utilitarianism and deontology, but we're going to hopefully get further into the arguments, get a little bit more advanced, because of course we did utilitarianism back with Brave New World, and we just did deontology with Deep Space Nine, and I actually want to start by following up on that one a little bit, because we didn't quite get into the discussion of the categorical imperative, and one reading of this story is that it's a sort of pretty standard issue deontological attack on consequentialism or utilitarianism, broadly speaking. I don't want to spend all of our time on that, because I don't want to get stuck in another, like, what is consequences conversation. So we'll make this an intramural conversation in a second, but I do think it's interesting to note that one way to read this story is laying out Kant's categorical imperative, and specifically a formulation of it. So the categorical imperative is an ethical claim that Kant believes applies to everyone, that everyone should, and the way the claim goes is, act in such a way that their maxims, their principles for action can be universalizable, can be treated as universal law. So I don't want to get too into that one. I think maybe we'll do another episode on that down the line, because there's a whole weird consistency argument there, but there's a reformulation of it that Kant does that is very well known, that is very applicable here, which is the famous don't ever treat other humans as a mere means, treat them as an end in themselves. So one way to read these kinds of stories, whether it's Snowpiercer or this, is it's, you know, it's condemning that world because it's taking a particular individual and treating them as a means to an end rather than as an end in themselves, as a being that could act rationally and adopt goals on its own. So that's sort of like a surface level interpretation here, though. I want to go a step farther and say, you know, what if this is really a debate within consequentialists about what the right distribution of consequences should actually be, right? We have a limited distribution of goods. What is the proper way to distribute it? What is the principle that we should base that on? And even there, there's a lot of argument. So first of all, let me just check in, right? You would be against Omelas, right? You, as a hypothetical, like, you feel like you would not vote yay on a society like this?
I mean, assuming, I think it depends on what your choices are. Like, okay. Obviously, if we're just speculating and kind of using general experience to say, because I don't know what the rules of this world are, but if it's like, well, I don't know, everybody has some sort of mediocre existence of some kind, you know, like, would that be, I mean, if the alternative, just simple math, like, if the alternative is everybody suffers as much as that kid, well then no, like, of course it'd be better to have one person suffer as much as that kid, but, like, it just depends on, I guess, like you're saying, it depends on the distribution, you know, like, what the answer would be. I guess if there's enough goodness units to make it so that everybody has some quality of life, then that sounds better than this, you know, high quality existence with this one thing. And something that I think is maybe interesting to think about, and this story I think outlines pretty well, is what can you really be happy with the psychological consequences of the suffering of this one person?
Yeah, that is a good question. Maybe we can get to that after dark as a sort of psychological question. So what you were saying there, I think, is great, because you're this is a question of distributive justice or alternatively like population ethics, depending on whether you're talking about what is the right thing to do versus, you know, what would be the better outcome. So people think that those two things can actually come apart. So let me start by setting us off with the like basic utilitarian position based on like Bentham and Mill. So there are folks who will say, for folks who don't remember back from Brave New World, right? It's the idea that all that matters is pleasure in the absence of pain, where everyone's pleasure and pain count the same amount, right? So everyone counts for one, figure out how to maximize the outcome, right? So this leads to a concept. This is a complicated one. This is a, like a three box level philosophical concept, right? So it's three A's: additive, aggregationist approach. Okay. Fancy.
All right.
Which just means when we're trying to figure out what the right outcome is, add up, that's the additive part, right? Add up the well-being of everyone, aggregate it all together and get a final number on, you know, number of utils, and that's how you figure out what the better outcome is, right? So everyone counts as one, so just add everybody up and whatever the overall number is, great. That's our best outcome, right? Sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds impossible to do, but sure.
Right, sure.
I'll go with you for the theory's sake.
Right. Impossible to do in practice, but in theory, that would be the way that we would figure out what the greatest good is. The problem that arises is it seems like there are various versions of the additive, that if we apply the additive aggregationist approach, we can justify some pretty horrible situations, including omelos, right? Omelos is a good outcome on a classic utilitarian model, it seems like, right? And unless you start to tweak the tweak the system a bit, which we'll talk about in a second, right? If you go by the numbers,
I'm all for tweaking the system and the scoring system, but that aside, I guess yes,
right? You see the problem at least, right? That it seems like if literally everyone counts for one, if you can take one person way way down, but you can bring thousands of people way way up as a trade off, that passes the test. And so like, and that seems bad to most people,
it
including
also seems
utilitarians.
Like it wouldn't be able to answer questions about population in the future. You know, like if some choice is going to get rid of half the people, how do you factor in like, well, the half of people left over are going to be really happy. They'll have so many resources.
Oh yeah.
So like, how do you evaluate those two different choices?
Yeah. The philosopher Derek Parfit spent a lot of time on this kind of questions. Then he developed this field called population ethics as a part of like a million different hypotheticals that are like,
I love population ethics. I did one interview on SIO for that a while back, and it's such an interesting subject.
Yeah, and you get into weird questions of like, well, if you change things enough, it's a different set of people in the future outcome, and does that matter and stuff? So you can see the problem. Early utilitarians saw the problem too. They weren't dumb. Mill wasn't dumb. So he tries to shift towards a kind of rule utilitarianism as a way to like resolve this problem. But what you see is when you start looking at different metrics, you still have various different kinds of problems. So one variation that you might think of immediately would be some sort of multiplicative aggregationist approach, right? Where you multiply maybe the well-being of certain individuals and you add up the well-being of other individuals, and so you create a complex equation as some way to try to avoid this, but it's not clear how complicating the math in that way would prevent some sort of version of omelos, right? You can eventually, you can always find a way to tweak the numbers to get these kind of repugnant conclusions,
right? Let me know if this is something you wanted to save for later, but I could imagine a different grading where it's you would way more prioritize absence of suffering in your point totals. You know, it's not as though sort of like
totally great.
You know, they always say money doesn't bring you happiness, but it does to a certain point. Like there's a level of money you have. I forget what it is. It might be like, I don't know, $60,000 or $80,000 in the US or something, where they've done studies and whatever and surveys, and they find that like, yes, money really does make you way happier up to that point. But then there's a certain point where it's like, yeah, more money really does almost nothing to your happiness once you have like a great baseline and everything's taken care of. Similarly, would the point total system, if you're looking at the total goodness points, whatever, the utils, mm-hmm. it should prioritize absence of suffering way more than like, oh, do I get to have a second Bugatti or whatever? Like that, yeah. That should be like, yep. No points, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been attempts to things like threshold systems or what these are sometimes called, where it's like,
yeah,
you value a certain thing up to a threshold. And then like, then you have questions of, well, how does the threshold actually work? Does the value disappear after that point? Does it start to like, is there like a gradient downward as you hit those diminishing returns? And this also leads towards these kind of distributive justice ideas that we've talked about some before with Rawls, which is where this is going to go again as well, which is the weighting of improving the well-being of those who are the worst off, right? So creating a distributive model where new goods or something are prioritized towards increasing the well-being of low-status individuals versus are distributed perfectly equally, for example. Mm-hmm. So this gets into different questions of distribution. So first of all, it's an important thing to note, the mere addition of the claim that distribution matters is a complication, right? It raises problems for us beyond what, you know, it would be preferable if the additive aggregationist approach just applied everywhere, because you could just do the math and you wouldn't have to worry about complicated questions of, is this being fairly distributed, right? Because now we're going to have to start bringing fairness in complicated ways into this. So one alternative that people will put forward at this point, at this step in the, you know, suffering down through the holes of ethics because we can't figure any of this out, is radical egalitarianism, right? Why not just distribute everything absolutely equally all the time, right? So this could be like an averaging approach rather than a additive aggregationist approach. So try to get everyone to an average of some sort. That, of course, has various problems as well. Everything I'm going to put forward here, right, has kinds of problems. I'm sure you're familiar with.
It's philosophy. Everything has problems. There's right. no... Is yeah. it like the end of philosophy class? They're like, and now here's all the answers that have no problems, but we don't want to tell anybody because then we don't have jobs. So, yeah, no, there's always problems.
it's just problems all the way down. So... Yeah. You're probably familiar with some of the problems that are often raised with radical egalitarianism from the conservative side of political culture, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I didn't yeah, and I think there are, you know, I think there are various levels of, or rather, like, some are not so serious, and some I think make sense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a matter of degree. I really do think mm-hmm. that, you know, my personal politics is I want things to be way more equal. But mm-hmm. if you are under some regime where everything has to be guaranteed to be perfectly equal and nobody can have any more than any one person ever, you know, like, and there's like imagine the amount of like mm-hmm. oversight and fascism that has to go into that all the time. And then like trying to evaluate how to, you know, there's a lot mm-hmm. of absurdities involved in that. And let alone like what does it really give you the inspiration to do a whole lot in your life? You know, like I feel like the freeloader problem is probably both overstated among conservatives regarding mm-hmm. like very minor like socialistic policies. And then maybe it could be understated if you're looking at some, you know, incredibly rigorous equality, some radical, as you said, radical egalitarianism. It does seem like there would be a pretty big freeloader problem there.
Okay, good. You hit on both of what I think are the two main concerns that I want to talk about with radical egalitarianism. I want to save the one about oversight for next week's episode because we're going to read a follow-up story to this story that I think is a useful one to fold into the conversation about potential risks of radical egalitarianism. But the one that the other one you described, I think we want to talk about now, which is this is sometimes referred to as the difference principle, that like the best systems are ones where people are allowed to like earn different amounts of money for the sake of if they want to work harder or something like that, that those tend to be more productive, flourishing kinds of systems. This is the principle that led Rawls to think that we should, if we can, come up with a concept of a just society that also has, that allows for some amounts of inequality. So he was sympathetic to the idea. And this is what leads to the famous Maximin principle, which is another famous, like probably the most famous principle of distributive justice. It's the second part of the second principle from Justice is Fairness, which we talked about a little bit in the Snowpiercer episode. And it basically says, you know, if there is going to be inequality, it has to be to the advantage of everyone, most importantly, the worst off within society. So it has to maximize the well-being of the people on the minimal end of things. And this leads to liberal redistribution of wealth kinds of ideas, right? This is really the philosophical core behind the progressive social safety net that you and I think both think is key to social progress, and that people like Nozick think is really problematic, right? Think that it's a harmful, like you were saying earlier, like a harmful invasion of people's freedom and redistribution with without justice. And so you know the next level of this argument is the libertarians who come along and say that any attempt to factor in these kinds of egalitarian or even Maximin balancing systems will cause more harm than good, and so we should stick to a libertarian as possible kind of system where, you know, if inequalities arise naturally, that's just the way things are.
Yeah, because that's working out great.
I'm not saying I'm in favor.
We're nowhere near the most libertarian possible society. Like, we're nowhere near that, and it's already way, way too much inequality. I don't know how someone could take that opinion with a straight face.
Yeah, one objection that often gets raised when you start to bring in these egalitarian arguments is called the leveling down objection, which says, you know, it's impossible for us to all get up to Bezos levels, but if we level everyone down low enough, then we'll have an equal system. And then you get back to the kind of concern you were saying earlier, where it's like, well, what if this requires leveling everyone in Omelas back down to the level of this kid or something like that?
Yeah.
Do we really think that a world where everyone is suffering that much is better or is more moral than a world where one person is suffering really badly and everyone's in really good shape? And I think, you know, and this is taking from some folks like Larry Temkin, I think you can say reasonably, yeah, it's better in one sense at least. I don't know if we can say if it's overall all things considered better, but it is better with regard to the principle of equality, right? It's a more fair system in that kind of sense. But what actually counts as equal, what actually counts as fair, turns out is an incredibly complex thing. Temkin, I think, lists a bunch of, I think he lists like 11 different distinct aspects to what could go into our considerations of egalitarian judgments, such as how much derivation there is from pure equality, how gratuitous the inequality seems, the extent to which individuals have an equality-based complaint. And then you get into things like luck. We haven't even talked about the luck side of this. There's a whole subfield called luck egalitarianism that says, like, things should be equal with regard to things that are beyond people's control, essentially. And you know that I personally think that nothing is under our control, but some folks will argue that, like, you know, it's okay for, if you make a particular choice and that ends with you having less money, but you chose that thing freely in an uncoerced kind of way, that's fine. It's only, you know, when you are bankrupted because of illness that happens purely because of luck, then that's a problem, and we should step in and address that kind of issue. Also, right, you get into sort of classic ideas. If you're sympathetic to punitive models of some sort or retributive kind of models, right? So you might think, for example, omelas is a better outcome if, instead of it being a small innocent child who's suffering, it's a hardened criminal or something like that, right? You might not be as worried if, you know, the system is running on the suffering of someone who it might seem like on some level deserves it, right?
Huh.
Or conversely, it might seem worse if, like, you know, it turns out that Omolas are full of monsters, and these are all terrible people who, like, don't mind the kid because 99% of them are sociopaths or something, then you'd, you definitely want to see Omolas burn to the ground at that point. So, and then there are, of course, are people who come in and say, well, luck isn't actually an important factor, and there are complications to applying luck and figuring out what actually counts as luck, and then horrible people like me come along and say it's all luck, and then we're back to radical egalitarianism or something like that. So you just go, you know, you go circling around through the theories.
I feel like there could be different versions of luck, at least. I mean, you and I both agree that nothing really is under anybody's control in an extreme sense, but like... Mm-hmm. If I, for some reason, feel like I want to work, you know, a 16-hour day, and you're like, I don't like working at all, I'm just going to sit and get high on the couch, and we're in a society that's like, everybody has to be perfectly equal. I think it's reasonable to say, okay, sure, it might be moral luck that I have a work ethic and you don't or something, but like, that should still be accounted for at least somewhat. Like, it wouldn't, it would stretch. There's different, like you say, I like when you said there's different kinds of fairness. It's hard to know exactly what fairness is. Is fairness is, you know, is it we both get exactly the same thing, or is it, if, you know, equal to like our inherent abilities or work ethic or talents or not? Like, it seems very hard to pin down exactly what would be fair.
Yeah, there are competing models of fairness. It is what I guess Toby over on Political Philosophy Podcast would call sort of essentially contestable. It is an essentially contestable concept. It's you know, there's a fundamental unresolvable debate about what we mean by fairness, or which concept of fairness should win out. And so a lot of what we're doing in politics is arguing for different conceptions of fairness from which different kinds of systems will fall out, essentially.
Well, what I hate about, if you're talking about politics, is we're nowhere near these hypotheticals. We're we're in a hypothetical where like 400 billionaires are the Omolas people, and then like a lot of people are the child locked in the basement. You know, like, it doesn't make any sense. We're not anywhere near like, oh, well, this is merely one debatable, you know, part of the utilitarian landscape that some people think doesn't make sense. It's like, no, what are you talking about? We're not near any of that.
It was funny because you said that, and I was like, well, I mean, one obvious reading of this story is we are in exactly this kind of society right now, because our society runs on the suffering of innocent people. So I was confused what you meant when you said it wasn't the same. And I understand now that you mean that, like, we're way worse than Omolas. Like, if only we lived in Omolas, that would be...
It would be great if we got to that. It would
be a huge step up. You're right. There'd be a lot fewer white nationalists in Omolas, I feel like. Or maybe they're all white nationalists. Maybe they're like, you know... Like, well, that's going to be the interesting thing for the next story, is because it's going to be another one by Jemison, and it's has Afrofuturism tied into it. And I think she kind of gives the impression that, like, Omolas is a white person's utopia.
Ooh, that's interesting. Well, that's a good teaser. I can't believe we're already out of time. That was a really interesting conversation. Really, really dense philosophy this week, which I like. Thanks for the lesson. And I feel like we barely even touched on all the concepts.
Yeah.
But that's such as the limits of podcasting.
Yeah.
But why don't we, you already gave a bit of a preview, but just to give the full preview for next week, what do we got?
Yeah, so next week we're going to read this is a short story, unfortunately, that you can't find online. You have to buy the book, When Do We Get Black Future Month, which I highly recommend. It's the collection of short stories by Jemison that also has Cloud Dragon Skies in it and a bunch of other interesting stuff. It's worth the price of entry. And so the first...
Have you checked if that whole thing is available on Audible? Because I would get the whole thing.
I haven't. I'm not sure.
Maybe I will.
Yeah.
I'll check. Yeah. I can recommend for people.
The story is called The Ones Who Stay and Fight. Hopefully that makes sense to everyone now, what the implications are there. Though it's interesting, it's not going to be what you think it's going to be. And we'll want to talk next time about what it actually is, because it sort of in some ways reads like a tacit acceptance that even a proper distributive utopia, right, the opposite of Omolas, would still have major problems with it. So again, right, moral of the story, everything always is terrible, no matter how good you try to make it. So yeah, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the problems with attempting a distributed system and get more into these things that we've unpacked some a little bit here.
I'm seeing how long till Black Future Month.
Sweet.
That's what you're talking
yep,
about?
Yep.
It's 14 hours. That's a lot of stories.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stories in there. But they're short, so you only have to listen a little bit at a time.
Okay. So it's the ones who stay and fight. I'm just trying to make mm-hmm. sure. I want to give like a recommendation for Audible people, but I'm trying mm-hmm. to verify that it's in there. Is it part of another thing? All right. I am seeing How Long Till Black Future Month on Audible, which is how I like to consume stuff. It is 14 hours of short stories, but I take it I'll be able to. I think I'm going to buy that anyway because I'm sure it's great. And then I can find the one we're going to do for next week. And sounds fun.
I imagine we'll be coming back to that well a couple of times. It's a pretty good well. So nice. I think we will make it worth
I'll,
it.
Maybe I'll listen to the whole thing, get some future material. All right. Well, let's go to patreon.com/0G. Check out what our amazing patrons are making you say this week.
Yeah. Thanks to our 25 tier AI level patrons, Locust Devouring Utils. You think this universe is bad? You should see some of the others. V. Frank, Corey Ebert, Winchester's Never Die, PKD is my favorite racist sci-fi author, HPL is a close second, it's great, and I was bleeped for saying pills. Oh, it's gonna get... I think you should have a fight with Brian. I think the two of y'all should fight. This is a good shtick. And then, very special, Most Utils in the Universe, thanks to our $50 tier, Definitely Not a Clone patrons, Philip Gatt, Jonathan Steele is a great dad fund, and Money for Utils, Capitalism at its finest. Thank you all so, so much. You make this all possible.
Okay, and now we're going to go for some After Dark. I know there's still so much to talk about, so please come and join us, patreon.com/0G. Listen to the After Dark. Listen to the bonus stuff. We got the... What else we got out there? We got NASA. That's always fun. Another one of those coming up in a few weeks. Hop on. Just pledge. I think it's little as $5. A month, and you get to enjoy all the good stuff every single episode. So hop on over there for some extended talk. Otherwise, we'll see you next time.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
What would it... So, if the short story were about vegans, would it be called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelets? Anybody? Anyway.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think ground control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.